You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the comet Neowise is making its nearly 7,000-year journey around our solar system, and this month is the only time to see it. We'll talk about that and other celestial bodies you can only see in the summer months. Now, our next guest was born in 1926, and she lived in western Wisconsin as people lived and worked through the Great Depression. Buna Coburn Carlson's new book is called Farm Girl, a Wisconsin Memoir. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. She goes by Bunny, and she recently talked about her memories with WPR host Keely Boltina.
Those of us who didn't live through the Great Depression, we've heard many stories about the struggles. Reading your essays, I feel like your nostalgia, maybe, your optimism. Why are you grateful for being a farm kid in Wisconsin during such hard times?
Probably because I learned such wonderful lessons that you don't have to be a victim, that you can find joy, that you can manage with what you have, that that you can go on, you can do things, you can make do, you can make the best of what you have.
Did you see people helping people?
Oh yes. That was the way we lived. The neighbors helped each other, and even the down and out neighbor who really lacked everything would be brought a loaf of bread, a dinner. People helped each other on the farm. If someone were injured, there was someone to help fill in. Yes, it was not a bad time. I think somehow those times brought out the best in people.
You write that you, as a kid, you had jobs to do to help out the family and the farm in the summertime, and that work was long and it was hot, but then you had time to do your own thing. What do you remember about those hours to yourself?
We played the wonderful old phonograph in the upstairs. We read, we raided Mother and Dad's old books and magazines. We, depending on who was friends with whom, we played with our brothers and sisters. We explored the entire farm. As I say, we were free range, like the chickens.
Well, those chickens you mentioned, too, and I think that resonates with a lot of farm kids, annoying the chickens and chasing the barn cats. That was part of your day.
Yes, that's right. And then, of course, we did have our jobs to do. And when they were done, Mother and Dad were very, very generous with us. We were able to explore. If we wanted to just sit and daydream, that was okay, too.
Oh, you didn't always have to be moving.
No, no.
You mentioned the phonograph, and you talk about in your writing that one of your favorites was literally a broken record. Why was that special to you?
Because of the music that was on it. I loved the Dvorak's New World Symphony. The part that was on that particular record was the Going Home song, which is haunting and lovely, and apparently other people felt that same longing that it produces.
And you know other people loved it because it had a chunk out of it, a chip out of it, so you had to be careful with it, right?
That's right, yes. Oh, the records were so scratched and raspy. I'm surprised that we got anything out of them. But we played them over and over and over. And it was not battery powered or electricity powered. It was crank handle powered. So it was available all the time. We didn't have to wait for the battery to be recharged. There was, of course, no electricity. So no electric devices were available to us. But that was okay. We loved that photograph.
food often shows up in your stories. Learning to cook, baking for Threshing Day dinner, eating what you had, especially in the summertime, but all year round. What's the connection between your memories and food?
Well, everything that appeared on the table pretty much came from the farm. We had a part in raising it, in harvesting it, in picking it, and preserving it. So food was pretty important. And we were very fortunate to have farm produce. There were a lot of hungry people who did not have that. So we counted our blessings and helped with the harvesting, preparation, and enjoyment of the food as we had it. I didn't learn a lot about cooking at home. I watched my mother. I didn't participate as much as my sister did. She was more the indoor girl and I was the outdoor kid. I did help with some of the like canning corn or canning the pickles, the cucumbers. We kids helped when we could, but mother was the major domo in the kitchen.
Bunny Carlson grew up in western Wisconsin during the Great Depression. Her recent memoir called Farm Girl is a collection of short stories, short essays she's written about those times. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Bunny, one of the stories you have in your collection is called Uphill Both Ways, and most of us recognize that as part of a joke that people tell kids about how hard their lives were when they were little and that they had to walk to school uphill both ways. It wasn't exactly that bad, but your walk, it was long. What do you remember about those walks to school in Wisconsin winters in the 30s?
Oh, I remember how cold it was, how bone-chilling cold it was, and the snow. Sometimes the wind had blown the snow off the road, but other times it was drifted across the road. And when the snowplow came through, sometimes it had to be the big caterpillar with cleats and lugs and big treads that left the road as unpleasant for walking as if they had not been plowed.
In the same story about walking to school, you write that for years during the Depression, your family had a car, but they didn't use it. Why?
They couldn't afford to operate it. Couldn't afford gasoline, couldn't afford repairs, couldn't afford tires, couldn't afford, I'm not sure if the insurance was required at that time, but I assume there was something. But there was no way they could afford to operate it. At least 2 years, maybe three, early in the Depression.
You write that your parents made less than $700 a year once running the farm during one of those years. What did you see them sacrifice?
Oh, my mother never had new clothes. She made her dresses. She patched Dad's overalls to the point where the patches had patches. And those patches came from worn-out overalls, so they were not very sturdy. Yeah, it was a struggle, but it was not an unhappy life. Mother and Dad were optimistic, had a strong belief that they were capable and they could manage. And they did.
Where do you think they found that strength?
I don't know what kind of an inner strength they had, but they lived through disaster and they drew on some kind of an inner strength that I don't know. I don't know.
Have you found as the years have gone on that you've had to tap into some of that kind of inner strength, that you've looked to them as an example?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And I think people right now are finding the same kind of experience that we had in the Great Depression. the Depression left us with no resources, no money. People were hungry. And now people are having the same kind of difficulties, but due to the pandemic. And they're finding the same kind of inner resources if they choose to.
Bunny, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for caring about this book.
That was author Bunny Carlson talking to WPR host Keely Boltina. Bunny's new book is called Farm Girl, A Wisconsin Memoir. It's a collection of short essays about growing up near Plum City during the Great Depression and published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Bunny now lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Coming up, we'll talk about all the things you can see in the summer night sky, including a visiting comet that you'll only be able to see again if you stick around for 7,000 years or so. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new reading list from the National Museum of African American History aims to help parents talk to their kids about race and protest. The creators of that list join the show to share advice and some recommendations. First, if you look along the horizon this month, you might see a unique celestial visitor, the comet Neowise. This comet will only be around for a short while, and we won't be able to see it again for thousands of years. The comet isn't the only thing you can check out this month. July and August are chock full of night sky objects, from constellations to meteor showers. Our next guest joins us to talk about what you can see in the night sky and the best ways to see them this summer. Jim Lattice is director of the UW Space Place. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Let's talk about this comet, Neowise. What do we know about it?
Well, it's a new comet, not one that was previously cataloged, because, as you mentioned, it has a rather long orbital period, thousands of years. So it was discovered back in March by an orbiting observatory, which is the name where the name Neowise comes from. And at that time, it was on its way inward to its closest pass by the sun, which happened, what we call perihelion, which happened back on July 3rd. And since then, it's been climbing out away from the sun and higher and higher into our skies, first in the morning sky. But now it's transitioned into the evening sky, and much more convenient for a lot of us. It's better viewing now in the evening sky than in the morning. Best of all, it's really exceeded the expectations for a comet. It's quite a bit brighter. Brightness of comets is very hard to predict, but this one has performed nightly to the point where we can see it without binoculars or a telescope. So that's great and relatively unusual. It's the best one we've had since the mid-1990s.
I understand there's some debate in the stargazing community about whether this is a good comet or a great comet. And those phrases actually kind of mean something?
Not to my knowledge.
Oh, okay. I've seen arguments online. Maybe that's just me. I don't know.
You can see arguments online about a lot of things.
True.
It's a comet that if you have a chance to go look at, you should not miss. Because, as I said, it's one of the best ones we've had since the 1990s. If you're going to wait for, I don't know the definition, you're going to wait for a great comet, then that's a mistake.
Now, talk about how we are going to see this thing if we get out after sundown.
Sure. What you want to do, probably about the best time is around 10, between 10 and 10:30 p.m., because the sky's got to get dark enough for us to be able to see it. It's over in the northwestern sky, just a little bit north of northwest, and kind of low on the horizon. So, for instance, this evening at about 10 p.m., it's roughly 15 degrees above the horizon. So that's relatively low. So to go look for this comet, what you need to do is find a site where you can look into the northwest where the horizon is fairly low. Ideal would be looking out over a lake or something along that line towards the northwest. And 15 degrees is not very high above the horizon. If you make a fist and hold it at arm's length and sort of sit the bottom of your fist on the horizon, which would be on roughly the surface of the lake, then the top of your fist will be 10 degrees. So the comet will be a little higher than that. And a big help are binoculars. I've been having a lot more trouble, success seeing it in my binoculars, whereas people with younger eyes pick it up a little bit quicker But you'll see it over there if the sky stays clear.
And did I see we can orient by the Big Dipper a little bit? That'll get us in the right direction, roughly?
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, if you recognize the Big Dipper, then at about 10, 10:30, if you look for the bowl of the Big Dipper and then look just down towards the horizon from there, it'll take you right by the comet.
Before we move on from the comet, talk about its flight path. It's going way, way out there now, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what comets typically do. They have very elliptical orbits, so they come in close to the sun, and then they recede to great distances. Some of the more famous comets, like Halley's Comet, for example, have very short period orbits. That's still like 76 years. It's very typical for comets to have orbits of thousands of years or 100,000 years. And the distant point in the orbit, what's called the aphelion, moves outward with Kepler's third law, moves farther and farther outward as that orbital period increases. So this comet will recede into the outer solar system before turning around and coming back. As you say, that's quite a few thousand years. So, but that doesn't mean it'll be that long before we see it, the next nice comet. But take a look at this one because they're very hard to predict.
Talking to Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, talking about the NEOWISE comet and other things to see this summer in the night sky. Let's start with planets. What kind of planet viewing opportunities do we have this summer?
Well, it's actually, it's really nice. This comet has come along, as I said, it's kind of exceeding expectations. And so if while you're out, after you've found the comet, 10 or 10:30 or so, in the northwest, turn around and look over to the southeast. And if you've got a nice horizon there, you'll see two bright objects, which are Jupiter and Saturn. Saturn considerably dimmer, noticeably dimmer than Jupiter, but they're both right over there in the southeast. And they're both relatively bright because they're both near what we call opposition, which is the point in when they're opposite the sun in the sky. So I think I think opposition might have been yesterday, or maybe it's today for Jupiter, and it's next week, I think on the 20th for Saturn. So they're both reaching opposition just by coincidence, about the same period of time. So they're both opposition means when the sun is setting, they're rising. So they're both rising about sunset. After you've looked at the comet, turn around over there. If you brought binoculars along to look for the comet, take a look at Jupiter, and you might be able to see Jupiter's moons. By the way, a good tip for using binoculars is to find a way to mount them on a tripod, whether for the comet or for the planet. It's especially helpful with kids if you can set up a tripod and fix the binoculars on the comet and then let them look through the binoculars after you've already aimed them. So Jupiter and Saturn are really great. And a little bit later in the fall, not until about October, Mars is going to be at opposition and really great, too. So it's going to be a great few months for bright planets.
And in August, the Perseid meteor shower is coming back for another show for us. Tell us more about why we see this particular meteor shower around the same time each year.
Well, so once again, we're talking about a comet, really. The Earth crosses intersects the Earth's orbit and the orbit of a few comets intersect. So the Earth actually passes through the orbit of a few comets. That's not the case with comet NEOWISE, for example. But when the Earth passes, intersects with the cometary orbit, we encounter the debris that comets leave behind them. And when you see a comet like NEOWISE, that tail stretching out there is just an indicator that the comet is literally falling to pieces as it orbits. And the pieces get left behind. They continue to orbit as well. But it spreads out across the orbit. So the Earth runs into these bits of comet material periodically, that is to say annually, and because we get to that same intersection every year at the same time. So in the case of the Perseid meteor shower, we intersect with the orbit of that comet in middle of August, right around usually the 13th, 12th or the 13th is when the peak of the Perseid activity is. And it's a pretty reliable meteor shower. Lots of meteor showers that are pretty meager. But the Perseids produce anywhere from 50 to 100 meteors per hour. So that's pretty good as meteor showers go. With any meteor shower, well, almost any meteor shower, it's best to get out early in the morning. And that'll be true. So after midnight hours, the moon is going to interfere a little bit with the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. But if you get out a couple hours after midnight on the 12th or the 13th of August, then you'll probably see some Perseid meteor showers, meteor trails crossing the sky.
All right, let's talk about stargazing with actual stars. What are the seasonal constellations we'll have a good shot at seeing this year?
Well, so excellent question. When you look over there in the southeast looking for Jupiter and Saturn, if you scan to the right back around towards the south, the next bright object you see will be the bright star Antares, which is a bright red giant star, and that's in the constellation Scorpius. So you'll be looking right at the constellation Scorpius, which in Wisconsin is kind of low on the southern horizon, even at its best, and it's nearing its best right about now. Then if you look higher overhead then, so turn your head up, overhead, let's see, about 10:30 is a little early. You'll look a little bit off to the east along about pretty much high overhead, a little bit off to the east. There's a triangle of three bright stars, which are Vega, Deneb, and Altair, which are in the constellations of Lyra, Cygnus, and Aquila, respectively. That's called the summer triangle because those three bright stars, it's a big triangle, dominate the sky all summer and on into the fall. Really, they're actually probably highest overhead. I'm estimating here probably around midnight. But you'll see them. They'll be up nice and high at the time that you're out by, say, 11 p.m. or whenever you're out looking for the comet.
A lot to look forward to. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You're very welcome.
Jim Lattice is an astronomer and director of the UW Space Place. He joined us to talk about the comet NEOWISE and other stuff we could check out in the night sky over the course of the summer. Coming up, it can be hard to talk to kids about issues of race and protest, but our guests share some advice and a new reading list. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on the morning show, the presidential race gets a lot of attention, but there's a lot at stake in state elections in November. Kate Archer Kent talks to a political reporter about the big contest for Congress and control of the state legislature. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, it can be difficult to know how and when to talk about difficult topics with children. And with the current issues of race, racism, and protests around the country, it can be hard to know where to start and what resources are available. Two staff members at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture put together a list of books for children and young people of all ages. Kendra Flanagan is the staff lead for the Teaching and Learning Unit of the Education Department at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. She oversees development of programming and resources to assist educators in incorporating African American history in their classroom. Also with us, Anna Hindley, director of the Early Childhood Education Initiative at the museum. Her work focuses on supporting positive identity development for young children. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us.
And Kendra, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. It's an honor. Thank you.
Anna, can you tell us why you put together this list of books aimed at children of different ages on these topics like skin color, racism, and protest?
Sure. So Kendra and I work together on this list because it is a concrete step in a practice that is the practice of being anti-racist and raising anti-racist, anti-biased children. The work really is daily. It's a muscle to build, and it's in each choice we make. And so with children's literature and books, that's something that most families value and bring into their homes. It's certainly in the classrooms. And so in those books, in those messages, like in the images that we see in books are incredibly powerful in telling children whose stories matter and the social cultural narrative. And so while the work of being anti-racist, like I said, is a practice and ongoing, looking at books with children is one concrete thing that you can do to really like critically assess the images and words children are digesting daily.
Kendra, you and Anna came up with a lot of titles for the list. Was it hard to find? Is there a lot of coverage of these issues in books for young children and older children?
The field and the arena of children's literature is constantly changing and reflecting our society and our societal needs and desires. So we've seen in recent years, and now more importantly within the past few months, an explosion of literature that is more aimed towards having these conversations, towards opening the door for these conversations with families, caregivers, educators, and the children that are in their lives.
And I could see a parent saying, yeah, I see race as a very important topic, but for a little kid, I don't feel like they're ready for that. What would you say to them?
Oh, my gosh. I think you just asked one of the questions I've been asked most in my career, because I think that is really heavy on the hearts and minds of adults, is that what they don't want to do is point something out that then leads to prejudice and bias and racism. Right. But what actually we're doing when we talk about what we see, talk about race, talk about difference, is we are really honoring children for who they are as learners. So what we know is that children see racing starting at 6 months. And by 3 years old, children are making decisions based on like who they play with, based on race. And then by 5, 6, 7, you really see those like pre-prejudicial thinking turn into prejudice. So by not having conversations, our silence is speaking louder than our words possibly could by saying this is taboo, this is something we can't talk about, this is off topic. But the reality is we live in a racialized culture where race matters and race impacts every one of our lives. And we have to have these conversations starting out in the like very early years, with starting from birth, in a way that is layered, so that celebrates difference but acknowledges difference. And then as the years go with the child's life, you can build in the conversations about justice and fairness, and you put it in the language that they understand. And every 3, 4, 5-year-old is going to relate to what is fair, what isn't fair, and what is hurtful. And so that's how we have those layered conversations. But it's a conversation that has to happen starting at birth.
And Kendra, Anna mentioned the conversations, and the idea of this book list isn't just hand the kids the book and walk away. You make the point on there that it's the books plus talking to the kids about what they're looking at, the pictures and the words. Talk about how we can have a successful conversation.
Absolutely, yes. Using literature, children's books as a doorway, as an opening for conversations, as a conversation starter with the children in your lives, is a really important concept. For many of us know that the more that children are read to, the more words, the more vocabulary, the more concepts that they're exposed to, the better for their overall growth and just intellectual and social maturity. Having books that talk about being anti-racist and that look at race and look at the history, it gives us an opportunity to really talk about these concepts, talk about the vocabulary, expose kids. It, again, speaks to what Anna was speaking about earlier, is like it gives us a way to have these conversations and not stay silent. Also with older children, thinking about a way into understanding what they already know, what they have conceptualized, what they're already understanding, and getting into that emotional conversation of what things may have happened to them, what may be happening in their own lived experience. Books give us that bridge to having those conversations.
We're talking to Anna Hindley and Kendra Flanagan from the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, looking at a reading list they have out on issues like racism, race, anti-racism, and protest for kids and their parents. Well, let's start naming some names, Anna. What were some of the titles you were most excited to get on this list?
Oh, my gosh. It was really hard to narrow it down to 12 books. Kendra and I are both such enthusiasts of books. And I think, though, what excites me is really is It's really that we can start at birth with children. And so the books like Shades of People, Shades of Black, both of those are so appropriate that you can start looking at with your infants and then layer in the language as the child grows. And we know that children really connect to photographs, and it's such an opportunity for parents to have rich conversations and also kind of have that safety net. If this is something new for the adult, a new conversation for the adult, that books provide that. And I love both of the images and Shades of People and Shades of Black, and the seeing the range of humanity.
And Kendra, how about some books as we move up to kids who are a little older than that?
Yeah, for me, particularly thinking about this list, Stamped by Jason Reynolds and Ibram X. Kendi, and the book Enough, 20 Protesters Who Changed America by Emily Easton. Those are two books that I think really speak to the historical foundations and give parents, caregivers, families, an opportunity to really talk about the history and where all of this conversation about race and racism, where this started, how it started, and give some insight on why we are where we are today.
And I want to talk about your audience here. Are you is this pitched toward parents with white children, parents with children of color, or all of the above?
You know, we did a lot of talking about this as we were developing this list, and we really did try to aim it for all of the above, that there's something for everyone on the list. I think there's certainly something to be said to focus on different social identities in books for those, because I think the conversation is certainly different with white parents versus black parents versus, you know, people of color. And so the conversation is going to look slightly differently for each family. And each makeup of a family, but we definitely tried to include something for everyone. I think the area on the anti-blackness was something that we wanted to offer that we weren't seeing in some other book lists, to really uplift the beauty of humanity, and that there's so much to celebrate about being black and for black people.
Kendra, if a parent goes through the list, gets through, burns through all the books that are appropriate for their kid at that age, are there other resources available at the National Museum of African American History and Culture that they could do then to follow up on that?
Certainly, yes. Well, we have a web portal called Talking About Race through our museum's website, which would be a wonderful place for parents, caregivers, families, educators to come and get some more background information for themselves, do some of their own thinking about how they interact and think about race and their own identity, as well as then some tips for opening up conversations with the young people in their lives. And then there are some outside organizations that we both, both Anna and I, also look to for resources and information. And for one that I think about often is Teaching Tolerance. And that's a really wonderful space, I think, for educators to really engage in.
We'll make sure we have a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time. Anna, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to add another resource that that we love to learn with and learn from is Teaching for Change. It's a DC organization that's local here, but also has national reach. And they've recently launched a program called Freedom Reads, Anti-Bias Book Talk Series. That's really incredible, and I hope everyone checks out.
We'll leave it there for now. Anna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Kendra, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That was Anna Henley and Kendra Flanagan from the National Museum of African American History and Culture. They joined us to share their thoughts and a lot of great resources on talking with children and young people about race, racism, and protests. We have those resources linked over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, Wisconsin Democrats are using a big fundraising haul to try to preserve seats in the state legislature and prevent a Republican supermajority. We'll find out which races are expected to see the most spending. That's coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, berries are in season and there's no better time to make pie. We'll talk to a Wisconsin cookbook author about her favorites and get some pie making tips. Right now, the state Democratic Party reported $10 million in fundraising between late March and the end of June. The party says it's the biggest quarterly haul it's ever seen. comes as Democrats in the state legislature hope to prevent Republicans from getting a veto-proof majority, and Wisconsin continues to have a high profile nationally as a key swing state in the presidential election. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What do we know about where this funding, what the Democrats say was a record haul, is coming from?
Well, I spent several hours the other night scrolling through this fundraising report, which when it's, you know, that many millions of dollars, it's a very long report. So I can say with confidence that I know that these were donations from all over the country. I saw donations as small as like $1.50 from places like Rhode Island and Texas, the Carolinas. But of course, there were also donors from Wisconsin, some big name donors. I think something interesting that stuck out to people as we look through this report was that one of the biggest donations actually came from the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker. He donated about $2.5 million. So, you know, just that donation alone has been the size of some previous fundraising reports. So definitely something remarkable there.
What do we know about how funding for Democrats and Republicans stacks up at this, you know, middle stage of the game, I guess?
So right now for this particular fundraising report, and this is just, you know, a 3-month snapshot in time, Democrats really left Republicans in the dust here. I mean, they raised several million more dollars for this particular fundraising period. And that's something that the Republican head for the Republican Party, the chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, wasn't too pleased about. When I reached out for comment, he said that, you know, he still believes Wisconsin Republicans have a great operation. He thinks that their data and ground game networks are stronger than Democrats. But he also called on Republican donors to really step up and send more resources to Wisconsin.
Is it typical to see a combo of in-state and out-of-state donations for either or both parties?
Yeah, that's definitely something we've been seeing. And that's something that definitely crops up in the conversation about donations, right? And kind of that political reaction. That's something that Republicans were quick to point out after this report came out. They said, you know, a lot of the big, you know, deep pocketed donors were not inside Wisconsin. They're from out of state, places like Silicon Valley, you know, California. Tech gurus, the founder of LinkedIn was one of the big donors for this particular report. So kind of the politics of getting money from out of state is something that we're pretty familiar with at this point.
And we're going to see a lot of it probably because Wisconsin is a swing state by some calculations, possibly the swing state in the presidential election. We're going to get in one way or another a lot of political love this season, right?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of conversation about us being the swing state, as you said. So I don't think this is the end of us getting a lot of outside attention.
So all this attention on the presidential race, but here in the state, there's a big issue in the state legislature. The idea that Republicans could get a veto-proof majority in both chambers of the state legislature. Can you talk about what's at stake in the state legislature?
This is a really big deal. Essentially, what is needed here is a 2/3 majority in the state assembly and the state senate. And if that majority is accomplished by Republicans, they can basically override any veto that Governor Tony Evers issues. I don't think, you know, it takes a lot of explanation to say that would be a huge deal in Wisconsin. There's been a lot of kind of back and forth between the Republican controlled legislature and the Democratic governor. And his veto is really one of the biggest tools that Democrats have in Wisconsin right now. So for the Republican legislature to get a bigger majority and to be able to kind of make that power moot is something that Democrats have really been playing up and saying, we absolutely can't let this happen. And I think that was a big part of their fundraising push that was so successful.
And when we see money coming in like this, does it then go for Democrats or Republicans, you know, sort of statewide into legislative races, or are they starting to pick and choose, hey, these are the ones that we either have to defend or try to flip?
So they're definitely focusing on specific races at this point. I mean, those funds can go all across the state, but there are kind of pressure points that Republicans have targeted as Democratic seats that they think they can flip to get to this supermajority. So in the state Senate, there are ones that people might be familiar with. Senator Patty Shockner, a Democratic senator who won kind of an upset victory in her district fairly recently. That's a district that Republicans are hoping to flip back. Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling. Some folks are probably pretty familiar with her name. She's been in the legislature for a long time. She's not seeking reelection. So Republicans have their eye on getting her seat. That's been a close race between the parties in recent years. And then Senator Dave Hansen in the Senate isn't seeking reelection. He's retiring. He's from Green Bay. That's a district that Republicans are looking at. In the Assembly, it's the districts of Robin Vining, Steve Doyle, and Beth Myers. So there's a lot of really specific kind of focus to where these flips might happen on the part of both parties, whether it's, you know, trying to defend it or trying to take it.
Talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White, looking at state legislative elections, fundraising for the November campaign, and more. Let's turn in our last few minutes to another issue going on here. Laurel, Governor Evers issued pardons, 18 of them this week, his second, I think, round of pardons. What kind of crimes were these pardons for?
So primarily, and this pardon process is very interesting because this is something that former Governor Scott Walker didn't do at all during his tenure in office. So something that folks in Wisconsin are getting a little bit reacquainted with. Most of the pardons are for kind of lower level drug or theft. So I think, you know, of the 18 people that the governor pardoned in this last round, he's pardoned about 50 so far since he revived this process. There were people that were charged with selling marijuana, usually when they were in their 20s or 30s, and now these folks are in their 40s and 50s. The process hasn't been around for a while, as I said, and there are some time requirements for after you completing your sentence before you're even eligible for this process. So it's often pretty far down the line after the crimes are committed. Some other things on there, cashing, fraudulent checks, making, inappropriate charges with credit cards or doing things with bank statements, things like that.
And we should clarify, and you pointed this out, Laurel, these are people who have completed their sentences in many cases years ago. When people think pardon, I might think, oh, this is somebody who's in prison now and they're getting out because they've been pardoned. That is not the case in these 18 pardons.
That's exactly right. That's not the case at all. So people have to finish their sentence and then any probation or parole that's part of the sentence and then have 5 years after that completion where they don't commit any new crimes before they're even eligible to submit an application for this process. It goes before a 9-member board. Then that board makes a recommendation to the governor and the governor chooses who he's going to pardon. So this is certainly not people who are currently serving sentences that are being released. And that's something that people who've been advocating for lowering the prison population in Wisconsin have been very keen and quick to point out that the governor's pardon process isn't doing anything to lower Wisconsin's prison population, which, as we know, our prisons are over capacity right now. And the governor had said that was something that he wanted to do during his campaign. And some folks have been pretty critical that he hasn't done more to do that.
And Laurel, briefly, as we wrap up, has the governor talked about why he revived the pardon process?
Well, we know that he said that, you know, he thinks that this is a valuable thing to recognize people who have done their time, who have contributed to society in meaningful ways. These are often people that have taken up jobs in their community or working in social service. So he sees it as not a fix to the state's, criminal justice problems or the stress on the correction system, but just a way to kind of integrate people back into society and give them some rights back that he believes they've earned.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She talked with us about a $10 million fundraising haul in the last quarter for the state Democratic Party. And we looked at Governor Evers' pardon of 18 people earlier this week. Coming up Monday on Central Time, kids are seeing a lot of news about political conflict lately. A psychologist joins the show to talk about the impact this can have on kids and to share some advice for parents. And contact tracing is a big part of the effort to slow the spread of the virus that causes COVID-19. But how does it work? We'll get a contact tracing 101. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, Kate and her guests talk about anxiety and depression, common conditions with big impacts on the people dealing with them. Find out more about the causes and treatments. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then in this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get some tips on how to make great summer pies. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.